Hello and welcome to the Bright Magic Podcast, the official companion podcast to the new public service broadcasting album, Bright Magic. I'm Rory MacLean, author of Berlin, Imagine a City, and another dozen or so travel and history books. In this podcast, we're taking you through the creation of this most special album, tracing its making alongside the history of Berlin that, and Berliners who, inspired it. All the while keeping in mind the idea that all our histories, personal, collective, are imaginative reconstructions, the ever-changing stories into which we look to understand the chaotic tumble of events of our lives. Who creates those stories, and to what extent can one control them? With that thought in mind, public service broadcasting set out to capture, to portray, to distill the essence, maybe I should say an essence of Berlin. And in the second podcast, we're looking at the second and third tracks of Bright Magic, Im Licht and Der Rhythmus der Maschinen. So, J. Wilgoose Esquire, tell me about why you needed to live in Berlin to make Bright Magic.
Yeah, good question. I mean, you know, I didn't go to space. I never flew in a Spitfire. Is a question on one level of authenticity. Although, again, you know, it never bothered Lou Reed, did it? I don't think he'd ever been there. And he wrote one of the definitive, you know, records associated with it. So I felt that it would add to the character of the record, and it may, in fact, add to my character. You know, it may add a richness of experience and depth that would just be interesting to experience as a person. You know, I've only ever really lived in London full time. I was away for university, but when you're in another city for university, you're not really experiencing that city. You're experiencing the student version of it. So, you know, I've been lucky to travel, gone all over the world with this and just, you know, in general, but I've not had an extended period of time living in another major capital city. So I thought, along with my wife, we both wanted to have a bit of an adventure. And we just thought, let's do that. I thought it would add to the texture of the record and the kind of, it would lend itself a kind of seriousness, I suppose, and a seriousness of intent and, you know, just showing this kind of level of dedication to what you're doing, that you're not just reading a few books and then whacking out a record from home. You are actually taking the time to really become fully invested in it.
There's the Somerset Maugham, you know, the great English novelist. He talks about the iceberg theory of writing, which is you have on the surface of the water, you have the tip of the iceberg. That's what's on the page. But underneath is all the bulk of research and background and life experience, which is needed to support that little bit that's on the surface. Does that have any ring of
truth? I think it doesn't. And to be honest, I think that's one of the reasons for doing this podcast, because maybe we haven't always done the best job of explaining the kind of depth of research and thought that goes into making one of our records. Perhaps to some people it does just sound like, you know, just whacking a load of old samples on top of some plinky plonky music. But, you know, I think there is a great deal more than that going on under the surface. And I think it's interesting to kind of, without giving any of the mystery and magic away, hopefully, to kind of explore some of the processes and some of the kind of techniques that we use but that's I hadn't heard that metaphor before, but it does seems like a particularly well thought through one, definitely.
Yeah. Well, this is the podcast with English novelists, I suppose. There's the novelist Lawrence Durrell. He wrote in his wonderful book, The Alexandra Quartet, four books, the first of which is Justine, about the role and consolation of his work. And I'll quote, he said, "Only there, in the silences of the painter or the writer, can reality be reordered, reworked, and made to show its significant side. Our common actions in reality are simply the sackcloth covering which hides the cloth of gold, the meaning of the pattern."
Wow.
I love it. But that's what you've done to me in 11 tracks, creating your Berlin.
I think it's nice of you to say that. I think I guess it just goes to the process of creativity in general, doesn't it? And what function it's performing, both for the person who's creating and for the people who are hopefully otherwise engaging with the results. And I was listening to, funny enough, David Bowie is talking about this the other day, and he was saying, you know, the reason you create is to kind of understand something about yourself in essence and the world around you and filtering it through you and putting it out there for other people, hoping that you are then showing them these things of interest that, that you've kind of sought to express. And if I can badly quote, misquote Alan Bennett from The History Boys, you know, he talks about art being this kind of hand reaching out to you, you know, saying, yes, I'm like you, I've felt these things, you know, and, and that sort of feeling of kinship and feeling like you're part of it when you're listening to or otherwise engaging with it. Yeah, it's, those are the threads that bind us together as humans, I think. Mm-hmm.
So if I can take half a step back, then how do you go about choosing your themes for albums? Do they choose you?
It's a good question. this is kind of an endless series of referencing other people, isn't it? But that's what we do as well. but Brian Eno, I was watching a documentary about Achtung Baby, which I fully recommend to anybody who's interested in that period of U2's history. And he said an artist's biggest enemy is their own history. And I thought that is interesting because actually looking at the way that we've worked in the past, I think a lot of the decisions I've made have been to either push slightly against or push away from the thing that came before it to stop people having too tight or narrow a definition of what it is that we do or even who it is that we are, I suppose. So we came out as this kind of very frothy, kind of quite kitsch, you know, arch and with a whiff of novelty that a few people wondered, would it be able to stay the course? You know, what are they going to do when they run out of archive footage was kind of one of the early things. So you come out of the traps as this quite kind of, you know, unserious but fun group, which is what we were, I think. And then you think, well, I want to be a serious artist. So here's what I'll do. I'll kind of hitch a ride on these rockets that went into orbit in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And I'll, you know, attempt to absorb some of that gravitas. And by way of that, we will become universally respected and immensely successful. And, you know, that was the race for space and it didn't quite achieve those goals, but it was, I think it worked in terms of what I wanted it to do. Just let people know that it wasn't just a kind of a sprinkling of sounds over these things. You could weave captivating and interesting stories and also play with those stories in interesting ways, you know, like moving the chronology of the record around and not necessarily sticking to reality when you're retelling these events, which you know all too well from your works. And then Every Valley was another attempt, you know, to push the boundaries of the kind of material that we use, the kind of stories that we can tell, and to move from telling a story that is by its nature thrilling and exciting and universal and superhuman in many ways. You know, these people are almost a different breed, astronauts and cosmonauts, and move to something much more everyday in mining, you know, and have these people who on a much more tangible level were actual heroes for doing the work that they were doing and sustaining all kinds of industrial and technological leaps in this country and then being absolutely shafted by the government in the 80s, having previously lauded them as, you know, heroes. They were then the enemy within. Could we focus on that? Could we look at communities as much as anything else? And could we tell a different kind of story? So that's Every Valley, which is all a very long way of saying, you know, we are kind of pushing against the thing that came before. And going to Berlin, you know, I knew I wanted to do it, but I also knew I didn't want to just do it and write this record that's ended up being about creativity and imagination, but just do it and have everything else be the same. So go there and just use samples and have clipped RP voices talking about, you know, oh, the history of the Berlin Airlift. It was a remarkable effort in the 1950s and it saved the city and repelled Stalin. And, you know, so how do you kind of continue to change the way you work? And that was the conscious part of the effort, was to change it. And then I think the unconscious or subconscious part of it is letting the answer to that kind of come to you by reading more widely and you know, letting all these influences kind of distill and filter through you. And then you work out how best to tackle it. And it turns out for a group who've made their name using samples and using kind of found material, the way to go against that is to move to Germany, make a record with hardly any samples on, and it's mostly in German. So that's what we've ended up with. So this has never been about success for us. It's never been about money. It's, you know, why would it be? Look at what we... Yeah, you wouldn't choose this path, trust me.
Same with writing books. You don't go in for the money.
It's about creativity. It's about flexing those creative muscles and challenging yourself as a writer and as musicians and as people, you know, move to another city, move to another country, learn another language. So all of that was part of the big reason for moving there, but also in terms of the subjects choosing themselves, they kind of do, but they're also pushing back against what's come before.
Yeah. So shall we go to 1920s Berlin? Because this is the Stanley Kubrick 2001 leap.
Yeah, the
we
jump
from,
cut.
From Der Sumpf and the founding of the Sandy City, the marshes, to the amazing 1920s. If you were wealthy enough, it's of course we see the sort of, we're used to the cabaret, the story, the sort of cabaret story, the Isherwood stories of Berlin. That was fine if you had a bit of money to spend, but there was also huge unemployment and all
probably
that.
Probably always the way, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah. But yeah, let's go to the 20s and Im Licht.
Well, you know, just in terms of the leap that we're talking about, you know, you've gone from this voiceless, solely animal noises of, you know, very animalistic and primeval kind of bubbling sound that I wanted to get for the first track, very natural, moving into sort of more synthetic sounds as the city's being constructed. And then the start of this track is a kind of burst of static. And then this woman shouting, "Mach schon." Which is "get ready," I think, in German, which is from Wochenende Ruttmann's piece that we've also talked about, his audio piece from 28. So, yeah, just I love the intent behind that. It's just get ready, because here we go. And also thinking about the live show, thinking about the impact of that moment, you know, you have this kind of bubbly, low-lit entrance with this kind of murky music that's kind of, you know, working its way up, and then people are kind of slightly in the right area, and then bam, you know, you're going to absolutely wallop them with all out audiovisual assault, you know, massive noise, massive light. And thinking about the stage show while writing the record was a big part of it. So you've jumped from this primeval kind of picture to now you're right in the swing of it into the middle of the 20s, this city of light and sound and animation and activity and inspiration and illumination, basically. Yeah.
The fastest city in the world, it was called. Because of the Second World War, that's so many people still cling on to that sort of dark vision of Berlin, but it wasn't like that in the 20s.
No, I mean, it literally was a city of light, wasn't it? In terms of its early electrification and in terms of the fact that it was making the light bulbs for most of Europe. You know, Siemens and AEG, I think, had two of the patents they were churning them out in the way that only German industry can. So yeah, it was the city of light. I mean, lots of places have had that title over the years, but I think Berlin in the 20s probably very much deserved it. And doing a bit of research leading up to the record, as soon as I read of this exhibition that took place, I think 1928, Berlin Im Licht, and it was kind of this showcase, almost like a great exhibition type event, but for Berlin, and just light everywhere, you know, celebrating this glorious kind of life-giving property.
The city was, you know, literally floodlit, bathed in dazzling light every evening by huge spotlights, and the Dom, the Cathedral, the Reichstag, the Rathaus, the Rote Rathaus.
The Karstadt, the big department store, because I lived just up the road from that, and they have a museum at the top, on the top floor, with a model of, you know, how it looked, and it used to have this amazing tower that was kind of lit up, and it was a light bulb moment, you know.
Ding! And I don't think people didn't sleep much during that first Im Licht exhibition. The mayor at the time said, Licht locht Leute, light attracts people. So and it did. And, you know, I think the highlight of the event was Kurt Weill writing that Berlin Im Licht song.
It's a very kind of jaunty, you know, parlor-esque song. I guess it's kind of And the lyrics are kind of, you know, what is it? Komm, mach mal Licht, come and walk in the light, you know.
Yeah.
I can't quite remember.
And das ist ein sämtlicher Stadt. This is no hick town. This is one hell of a city. One way to translate it. If you want to see everything you can, you have to use a few watts.
There you go.
And it was it's overshadowed by what we know about the Depression and the rise of Nazism. But in the 20s, well, certainly by 28, in social and economic terms, Berlin and Germany were on the up. It was a period of stabilization. The economy was not performing badly. Unemployment was down. Industrial production was up. So it was a really positive time. But then 1929, the Wall Street crash, which, due to all sorts of reasons, really impacted Germany. And people wanted another story. Mm. And we know what that led to.
Yeah. The other thing about Im Licht is imagining the city ablaze, and having gone on to read about Dietrich by this point and knowing the lyrics to one of her most famous numbers from The Blue Angel, which is men gather around me like moths around a flame, you know, and I thought this city is this kind of tempting beacon. It does draw people in, and you know, having it kind of lit up in this way is almost doing that, you know, it's drawing people in like moths. And the other aspect to it is some of those people who get drawn into it do kind of become destroyed by it, which will come on to with Anita Berber, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And
yes.
You know, there is a kind of destructive side to the hedonism that lures so many people in. But it was another reason to kind of focus on this imagery, I suppose, was to have these little threads that run throughout the record.
Yeah.
And it won't take a student of German to look at the track listing and realize that light is quite a big part of it. I think it's in at least five titles, yeah. 5 out of 11. So, you know, we're kind of hitting people over the head with that one. Yeah.
So here we've got the light bulb as a practical innovation, but also a symbol of imagination.
Yeah, that's why it worked so well. You know, it's kind of alluding to the industrial past of Germany while also hinting at the creative explosion at the same time. The record is in three parts. The first part is setting up Berlin and how it was built, building the place itself with this emergence of it from the swamp and then the industrial explosion that really drove it. You know, obviously you've jumped over huge passages of history.
What about Frederick the Great? I don't understand why he's not there.
I know a very good book if you're in the market for understanding those interim years. So, you know, but just to jump into it and then have this industrial drive and this energy sort of be the focus of the next two tracks, which we're talking about today, and then on into the next segments of the record. But it was important to make that leap and have that kind of link between the very industrial nature of the city, but also the imaginative side. And I think going there today, it's quite telling, you know, London's industrial past is kind of mostly vanished, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go out east, you still see stuff like the Tate and Lyle sugar factory and stuff like that. But a lot of it's been repurposed for this, that, and the other. And of course, the dreaded luxury flats. But in Berlin, you know, it's heavy. There's heavy industry still there. It makes its presence very much felt, mm-hmm. which for somebody coming there from London was quite an interesting kind of juxtaposition, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Let's go more into the light bulb. Let's take apart. Yeah. As much as you're willing to without undermining the illusion.
Yeah. I think this is the most fun we've had in the studio as a band, was making this one track in Licht, because we just had all these daft ideas. I mean, most of them were my daft ideas, I have to say, but kind of taking inspiration and cues from the bands that had come before us in Hansa, like Depeche Mode and Neubauten as well. Einstürzende and Neubauten, if I'm allowed to show off my...
Very
pronunciation, who we'll come on to talk about in a moment as well. And you know, the way that they used unconventional instruments in the studio and the way they also smashed stuff up, you know, that's good fun. Turns out smashing stuff up in the studio is really good fun. You know, we wanted to do a bit of that ourselves. And going back to the question, why did you feel you needed to move there? I suppose I was trying to, on a writing level, trying to absorb some of the pulses and energy of the city into my writing. And you know, in most cases that was metaphorical, but actually in this song's case it was literal, because I ended up getting hold of this electromagnetic interference picker-upper device. So it's a weird...
That's the technical term.
Yes. Sorry, I don't want to alienate any non-technical listeners. But yeah, it's a device called the Ether, and it's made by Soma Synths, who are based in Russia, I think. And I saw a demo for it. It looks like a horror film, because this guy's walking down a train carriage pointing this weird device at lights, and this horrendous noise is playing. But basically, it kind of, you point at electrical objects or you wander down a street or whatever, and it just picks stuff up. And, you know, you could point it at a neon light and it'll make a certain noise. You could point it at, it made a very interesting noise on the escalators. So that's my top tip. I thought, well, Hansa is just around the corner from Leipziger Straße, which is the first electrified street in Berlin. Mm-hmm. So why don't I get this little box and way too many cables and wander up and down the street, record some of these impulses and put them on the track. And, you know, you hear some of these things in the sort of the bursts of static and these kind of harsh sounds that are kind of littering the early part, especially of the track. But also I went on to manipulate them in other, what I think are interesting ways. So yeah, this is the noise of me wandering down Leipziger Straße and just wafting this thing around in the air and trying to pick up interesting pulses. And it's not particularly musical in its raw form, but you can kind of take this raw material and some of these noises just cut up and sliced rhythmically are in the track. But I also thought you might be able to do something more interesting with it. Yeah. And there was one section in particular where it was just a very regular kind of but noise. And I thought, I think I can do something more musical with that. Those little impulses, because they're separable, you can take those and you could take the impulse. It's basically just a tiny click. When you zoom right in on the waveform, all it is a click, which in essence is all a bass drum is when you synthesize it. You're taking an attack, you know, you're taking that kind of sound and you're then adding resonances to it that kind of die away. But essentially, you can make a bass drum out of that sound. So I took that tiny little impulse and pitched it down a couple of octaves, and then add a filter to it, you add some resonance to it, you find the right tuning to make it sound like a bass drum, and that is the bass drum for the track. It's a tiny pulse that I picked up walking up and down that street, and it turned into this pretty cool sounding bass drum, I think.
And then light bulbs.
Light bulbs themselves lend themselves to being played quite well in the studio. If you hit them with tiny little metal hammers, and Wrigglesworth, to his credit, I don't like to give him credit, but I will do in this case. He's proved to be very adept at playing them without breaking them or hitting them too hard so they fell out of the improvised holders that
these
we had
are
for
sort
them.
100-watt light bulbs? Or are we talking very modern light bulbs or spots? Or
no, obviously they're 100% vintage sourced from the period, you know, antiques, extremely valuable, not from IKEA.
Okay, there's the clue, listener.
So, no, it was basically the night before we recorded this, I said to our assistant there, Kian, who's a lovely chap, I said, oh, we need some light bulbs for tomorrow. And can you bring in a big one that we can smash? And poor bloke, he brought in his like cherished massive light bulb from home that I think he used on a daily basis. And we said, can we break it? We'll come to that anyway. But first of all, the light bulbs. Yeah, we had a little, you know, light bulb tuning session, and we listened to the ones that sounded best and had the best character and tone. And then, we used them as a kind of as a straightforward percussion kind of click sound, but also a busier kind of passage played with them. And I, for the really nerdy music folks out there, I ran that through a device which is called a comb filter, which is like a resonant filter where you can tune it to a note. So it kind of moves with the notes of the song. It starts on a D, moves to an E, and that kind of embeds itself in song musically as well as kind of rhythmically. So it was really fun stuff, I think. Yeah. But extremely geeky, but really fun. I don't think we'll tour them, but we'll probably just take the samples with us.
In the front of the stage, all the light bulbs there, a line of light bulbs.
Yeah, well, actually, going back to the stage show, I did think, because you start the song with this enormous kind of assault. You know, this kind of crescendo and this ascending pattern of hopefully exciting kind of synth that's just going up and up and up. Stops, and there's just a single kind of pulse in the background, just this kind of boom, boom, and that for me, I just picture this one light bulb hanging above the stage and just that pulsing after this enormous, you know, multi-million lumen assault. You've got this one thing kind of pulsing, and then it builds up again. So I mentioned earlier about Kian and his big light bulb, I think it was about 20 centimeters across, and we said, you know, can we break it? And he was very obliging. So we put it in a plastic tub, gave Wrigglesworth a hammer and a small cloth to protect his hand just in case anything went wrong. He'd recorded all his drum parts by now, though, so, you know, the risks were low.
Very sensible timing.
To end the song, we wanted this big explosion, but we also used smaller kind of smashing light bulbs and reversed and time stretch and pitch shift stuff as symbols. There are some conventional symbols in the song as well, but a lot of the percussive effect and a lot of the kind of explosive effect is of these breaking light bulbs. And then you get to the end of the track and you just hear this one enormous
apart
kind
from
of
the
smash.
Studio assistant.
Huge when we did it. We were all giddy with excitement. It was great. Good way to end a song. But then we kind of thought, you know, going a level beyond that as well, we've got these small pieces of light bulb and there was a small plastic tube in the studio. Can we just put them in here? You know, so we gathered up the shards and poured them into it and then sealed it off with tape so, you know, Wrigglesworth wasn't shaking just loose broken glass, and turned it into a shaker percussive effect. So we've got a conventional shaker on the track. We've also got this kind of homemade PSB smashed glass shaker, which I've still got at home. It sounds pretty good, I think. And we put the harmonizer on it as well, the Eventide harmonizer, which Visconti famously used all over Low. And it kind of shifts it down a bit, but adds a little bit of movement and pitch and depth to it and randomness. So that's, yeah, homebrew PSB shaker, but we also trying to use more of the outboard equipment in these studios, because you're paying a reasonable amount of money, not just for the room and the equipment and the expertise in the actual recording areas, but obviously in the control room area. They have a whole load of equipment that we couldn't possibly dream of affording. And they've got these old reverb units, very early reverb units, but there's one that's called a Quantec, and we ran the exploding light bulb sound through it, and it's got this button on it that says freeze, which I was instantly drawn to. So we ran it through it, and I pressed freeze at an opportune moment, and you can just hear this kind of fizzing sound that's sustained. And I thought, well, you could chop that up easily, pitch it one way or the other, and you'd get a hi-hat sound out of that. So the electronic hi-hat sound in the song is the smashed light bulb run through the Hansa reverb, frozen and then manipulated. It all kind of feeds into itself and out of itself, but I was really having a good time with this track.
So that was Im Licht. So let's move on now to Der Rhythmus der Maschinen. In Im Licht, there is the industrial, there's the mechanical, there's that Berlin of the 20s, which, as you alluded before, it was you know, coming out of the First World War. There was a real nihilism in Berlin, and many people thought the way forward would be with the machine world, which leads to some of the films we're going to talk about, leads to Metropolis. And you've captured that in Der Rhythmus der Maschinen, the rhythm of the machines.
Yeah, I think it goes back to trying to paint this portrait of Berlin as a very industrial city, and especially I think the importance of the railways in driving it. The engine of growth of Berlin in the late 19th century, was certainly the railways. So getting some of those sounds on the record was really important, I think. But at the same time, Yeah, the title comes from a film called Berlin Stadt der Millionen, which is Berlin City of a Million People, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1925, Adolf Trotz.
There you go. there's kind of one of the cards in that, you know, because it's a silent film, so it's just got captions throughout, and one of them just said Der Rhythmus der Maschinen, and I thought that's a very good title for the song that I'd like to write. And it was an attempt to marry both that more pragmatic kind of industrial history of Berlin, try and get that into the record, but at the same time have this almost industrial apocalyptic sort of hellscape sound. You know, it sounded like one of the words for Moabit was Feuerland, wasn't it? Fireland.
Feuerland, yeah, from Moabit.
Yeah.
The neighborhood.
Which is where a lot of the heavy industry was. So for some reason in my head, that led to this strange concoction of music.
Yeah.
And certainly the opening 5-10 minutes of Metropolis were very much in my head when I was trying to conjure up a kind of an image of what I was writing to, you know, all these kind of whirring cogs and this heavy machinery and this sort of city of the future.
Yeah, it's a futuristic urban dystopia, of course. It's Fritz Lang's great film, arguably the first science fiction feature film.
But also the colour was a weird part of it for me. And Metropolis is black and white, so you wonder how colour comes into it. But I think every time I think about that film, I just see the poster, which is so just sort of striking. It's bathed in this golden light, you know, and the picture of the kind of robot queen, you know, the film is kind of looming large over everything. And yeah, it just kind of it bathed the whole song in this kind of weird metallic robotic glow. Mm-hmm. And it was trying to write while under that atmosphere. I actually had a lot of difficulty getting going with this track. You know, it was a real kind of like crisis of confidence moment in terms of the record. I write the records in sequence, so this was the third thing I'd done. I was reasonably pleased with the first two. You know, I thought I was on the right track, and then came to this and just thought I was going mad, basically, and wondered what I was doing with my life. But
I would say that's very apt, because that's where Berlin was at that moment, because after the First World War, the old steady values of morality, of ethics, of decency had all been lost, and people were searching for something new.
I like to think it's me tapping into that, you know, subconsciously, but I think it's just because
definitely,
I'm an extremely average
Jay,
musician.
Definitely.
thrashing about for ideas.
Think of the iceberg, yes, you know.
Yeah. I think I had lost sight of what I was trying to do and why. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very important thing when you're writing, is to just occasionally step back and say, what am I trying to achieve with this? And how do I think I'm going to do that? You know, and those answers might change as you're doing it, but you still need to occasionally bring things back to that.
It's quite common. The cliche for writers is you get to chapter two, chapter three, and that's where things start to go wrong.
Is that a cliche? Yeah. I wish I'd known that at the time, because I think I would have given myself a much less hard time about my deficiencies as a writer and as a musician, because I genuinely was not having a fun time when I was trying to make this. I'm not very kind to myself when I'm writing anyway. I don't know what you're like when you're writing, but I'm frequently just the voice of abuse myself in the head, and you know, it never seems to get much easier no matter how many records we do. It actually gets worse, which seems a bit cruel. But I wasn't being very kind to myself and wasn't really enjoying it. And then thankfully, you know, a gradual kind of examination of what I was trying to do and why and how, and a realization that everything I had done up until that point was at totally the wrong tempo. It got me out of it. So
it
was too slow. That's why it turned rubbish. So I sped out and it was fine.
I'll try that next time I'm on chapter two or three. I'll just speed it up.
Just maybe the equivalent is bump the font size up or down. You know, maybe that's...
Well, I don't know if my editor will accept that, but I could give it a go.
Double space it. I don't know what the equivalent is yet.
So take us through Der Rhythmus.
Well, yeah, it started trying to weave these industrial threads through the record, and you know, I had Wochenende in my hands, you know, I had all these contemporary sounds of industrial Berlin.
Yeah, so that's Walter Ruttmann's.
Yes. The kind of audio collage that was put out, I guess, in 1930, but I think we think it's recorded in 1928. I had all these sounds, so the idea was to kind of take them and chop them up and, you know, with the aid of modern technology, slice all the humanity out of them and turn them into ruthless grid-based musical machines. There was one kind of, I've never really identified what the machine was. It was kind of chugging engine sound interspersed with this kind of burst of almost static. And you can't help but hear a rhythmic thing when you hear it in situ, but then you can quite easily turn that into kind of a rhythmic effect for the song itself. Yeah, you can hear the tempo definitely changed.
Definitely. I've seen the light. I've seen the light.
But also, I think I used the same comb filtering effect on that. So, you know, you can give it a pitch, you can give it a note, and you can change that note as the song goes along. So it becomes musical as well as rhythmic. And then, you know, there are all kinds of other sounds within Vocanenda that I went through and kind of sliced out. There in kind of raw and in some cases unmusical form, but with a bit of imagination and a bit of technical knowledge, I suppose you can turn them into kind of rhythmic effects, whether it's the sound of a bell and you can turn that into a percussive instrument, a really heavy clank that you can pitch shift down a bit and turn into kind of a bass drum sort of thud. All of these things were kind of taken from the original form, and then you should be able to hear the finished collage of sounds that really give the song its tone more than anything. You can kind of hear it's got this very effective rhythm, I think, and yeah. It's this sort of apocalyptic industrial percussion section, but also being a bit of a Bowie geek and wanting to pay tribute to him wherever possible. The start of the track with a sort of, I always call it a flanger, but I think it's called a flanger. It's a sort of flanged train sound, basically, and that was supposed to recall the beginning of Station to Station, which I think the whole record starts with, mm-hmm. that kind of sounds. Another little kind of nod his way, really. Mm-hmm. And those are littered across the record as well. It was interesting because sometimes I had the outputs of that track routed in a certain way out of my audio interface, and sometimes I had something else plugged in by mistake, so I couldn't hear them. And I'd be listening to the rest of the instruments thinking, this doesn't sound right. This is something very important is missing here, and I couldn't work it out. I could hear the drums, I can hear the bass, I can hear the synths, I can hear the guitar. What? It's like, no, it's this kind of bedrock of these industrial sounds. They're providing such a crucial kind of sonic bed, you know, as a sort of texture for the whole thing, that if you take them out, it really does weaken the whole composition. And I think, as I was saying earlier, it can sound a bit like, maybe to some people, like we just kind of whack clips on top of stuff and, you know, it's all just, you know, very haphazard and lazy and just, you know. But actually they are fundamentally woven into and become the purpose of a lot of these pieces of music.
For me, it's not an echo, it's sort of hinting at what's to come when we get to People Let's Dance and the techno Berlin. They sort of echo each other. The machines of 1920s Berlin and techno contemporary Berlin. And PSB's first guitar solo? Guitar solo?
I mean, I've brought this in. I don't know if it's just, you know, is it ego on level? I just want people to, you know, I can play. But normally, actually, there is a reason for talking about it that isn't just, you know, listen to this guy set these frets on fire. No, it's like I've always kind of shied away from stuff that's too technically showy on the guitar. I think I know I can play reasonably well, but often when I've demoed stuff, I've done something that is a bit kind of more involved. And when I listen back to it the next day, I think that's too much. It's taking the attention in the wrong direction. You know, it's mm-hmm. never really about the musicality of the song first and foremost. But I think with this track, something about it just lent itself to this kind of really, you know, it's a very kind of distinctive guitar sound that I kind of cooked up via various kind of effects pedals and bits and bobs. It almost sounds like you should be playing this with a guitar that kind of has fireworks coming out of the headstock or something. You know? It sounds like you should be watching on a stage with flames kind of rising up all over the place. And I just think if there was ever a place to kind of really cut loose a bit more, maybe this is the moment to do it. So I did go a little bit more to town on it than I normally would. It was fun. I mean, maybe it wasn't that much fun to record, actually, because I think it was a number of takes. It's reasonably difficult. That's what happens when you write something on the synth first and then try and play it on the guitar. It doesn't always lend itself to being particularly easy to play. But I'm looking forward to that one live.
Yeah.
I'm certainly looking forward to the others laughing at me when I fail every night to get it right, which is bound to happen.
So we've just mentioned the technology of industrial Berlin in the 20s and modern techno Berlin. You touched on another part of Berlin history, certainly musical history, with Blixa Bargeld, who was there in Der Rhythmus.
Yeah, that idea actually didn't come from me, which I'm not sure I should admit to, because it kind of, maybe I'm not keeping a tight enough creative control on things, which I've never accused myself of before. But I just thought he wouldn't want to, why would he be interested in working with us? You know, he was the driving creative force behind Einstürzende Sender Neubauten, which is, I think, is that collapsing new builds in English?
Yes,
like that?
Yeah. It sounds better in German.
Yeah. And he was such a kind of formidable and singular presence in Berlin in that period. He was famously inducted into the Bad Seeds by Nick Cave and, you know, was part of some of their most famous recordings. I think, you know, I'm pretty sure he's on the Mercy Seat. He's on the Weeping Song. You know, he sings the duet with Nick Cave on the Weeping Song. He's a fabulous guitar player. He's an unbelievable guitar player. He's done it all. He doesn't need to add anything on sort of terms of industrial or, you know, he doesn't need anything else on Berlin, you know, Imagination, Hansa. He was part of the original story of all of that. And in fact, when I was doing a demo of this, long before getting him involved, I was regularly listening to the Neubauten track Futter Mein Ego, Feed My Ego, I think. And it's such an amazing piece of music. If you don't know it, please listen to it. It's one of these things, it's quite long. And at first you think, oh, am I really going to be able to stick it out for 6.5 minutes or whatever? But by the end, you are totally sold by it. It's turned into kind of like a proto-industrial rave track or something. It's unbelievable. And it has this kind of percussive bell sound going through it, which is, I think, added, you know, I use some of the sounds from the Wochenende film to try and echo that. You know, my manager asked me, do you want to try and get Blixa on this track? And I said, well, he'll say no, but you may as well ask, I suppose. And then word came back that they had asked and he had said yes. And I said, are you sure? has he actually said yes, or his manager said yes and then he's going to try and strong arm him into it somehow? But then, you know, word came back again, like, no, it's definitely, he's interested in, you know, sent the demo, he's interested in the track and maybe we should talk over. It was in the middle of pandemic. So, mm-hmm. you know, we mm-hmm. spoke remotely. Mm-hmm. So we did. And, you know, he was very straightforward. He didn't particularly want the whole backstory of the record or anything. But he was, you know, he seemed up for it. So yeah. When I was in Berlin in September to record it, I went to Neubauten studio. He had actually gone to Portugal by that point. So we recorded him remotely in Portugal, but from the Neubauten studio up in Wedding, I think it is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yeah, it was quite an experience. He's an interesting man to work with. He really gets into it in the studio. You know, I don't think he does anything without conviction. No.
You can hear that in his reading.
Yeah, it's what he'd originally done, the lyrics that he'd originally written weren't really what I was after. Mm. You know, having some of that trepidation approaching it, I was a little bit unsure of how best to broach that and say, we need to steer it in this certain direction because the song has this place on the record and this is what it needs to be saying, you know. He was very open to listening to that and taking the feedback on board and he rewrote large sections of it and then delivered it in a fantastic manner and then that was it, we were done. What he ended up doing wasn't what I'd had in mind even when I approached him, but I think that's the point of collaboration is you get someone else's involvement because you want their voice, you know, not just their physical voice, but their artistic voice and their influences on your track. There's no point just going to somebody and say, can you sing this exactly the way I want you to sing it? You know, you want them to change the music. You want them to add another character to it. And I think he did a really great job of doing that.
I think it's really captured, I think, the spirit of the time, of that kinetic, rhythmic industrial city. And the English translation, the first couple of lines are, the city is the machine, engineers in the huge machine form the new man.
Ah, yeah,
great.
I mean, yeah, and again, you know, how metropolis is that?
Yeah.
it's his delivery, it's almost like he's sort of this, the voice of God, you know, kind of. He's got such a great delivery. It's so rhythmic. And the German language is incredible for that as well. Entverstärker. You're not going to power amplifier in English. It doesn't work, does it? You need these the German way of getting stuck into words. It really kind of helps, I think, yeah.
And Der Sumpf sneaks back in here. Der Sumpf, the theme.
I think actually, if I was going to be technical about it, I'd say it was, you know, Symphonie der Großstadt. I think that's what that part of the song is alluding to, is the fact that there's this kind of germ of a symphony within that track. which is that melody. And yeah, it kind of rides again over the outro of this song, almost as if to say, you know, we started not that long ago, we started in the swamp with yes, this.
How many minutes yeah, have we?
And now look where we are, you know, with this kind of fire escape, you know, and you know, belching machines and machinery. And, you know, again, a lot of the cymbals in this song are actually just steam effects manipulated and played with, you know, so it's kind of which is essentially what the cymbal is doing anyway. So it's performing that function, but just in a more interesting fashion. The actual conventional drum track is Wrigglesworth playing, you know, bass drum toms, but we also got him to bring along his brake pad, which he had knocking about, don't know why.
His brake pad?
Brake pad, which is, you know, it's quite a substantial bit of kit to mount on a drum kit. But yeah, that kind of metallic clang you get when he's hitting these drums, it really rings through and carries with it these echoes of industry and kind of labour. And it was another really fun one to put together in the studio, definitely.
Well, thank you, Jay Wilgoose, the Squire. And thank you for listening to the Bright Magic podcast. In the next episode, we'll be looking at the fourth and fifth tracks of Bright Magic, People, Let's Dance and Blue Heaven. But to finish, let's hear the albums Der Rhythmus, Der Maschinen in full.
Machines will do the heavy work. Men will supervise the machines.
Thanks for listening. The Bright Magic podcast was a 4Kicks production, and the producer was Tom Pooley.